Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm joined with Emperor Beef today, and we're just going to talk about his favorite game, or games, right, plural. Hey,
thank you for having me in your studio today.
It's a nice studio, isn't it?
It's really nicely upholstered.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope it's not too tacky or anything.
Oh, no, I think it's just great.
Good. So I asked you what your favorite game was, and you actually had like a whole list. You had a whole bunch of different things. So I didn't bother putting up a gameplay of any of them because I thought you just might want to go through and just kind of get to the core of what makes your favorite game and why that is.
All right. Yeah. So first of all, favorite game, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. If I'm thinking about favorite game in terms of what game do I just play the most? Mm. That's like one answer. And just like, what do I spend the most time on? But then I'm thinking what game means the most to me in terms of I don't know. And that's tied to certain points in your life. Right. If I think about the first video game I ever played, or the most influential video game, on my weird child psyche, there's a lot of answers there too. So first off, how would you define favorite game?
I think you kind of actually hit the nail on the head, because in one of my videos, it's the best game or your favorite game or whatever is the thing essentially that you remember the most, or it gives you the most memories, or something that is it's almost like a lucid dream. You remember it so clearly, and usually the correlation to that is that game had a lot of impact on you.
Yeah, impact. Mm-hmm. All right, so if I had to say the game that had the biggest impact on me as a kid, it just occupied 90% of everything that I was thinking about at any given time, was Super Mario World for the Super Nintendo. Mm-hmm. I know that's kind of basic. It's kind of mainstream. To my child brain, this is the first time I had seen anything like this. And it just defined what a video game was to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of video games at home as a kid. And this is just the thing that was at my older cousin's house. Mm-hmm. And anytime that I would go over there, I would just immediately make my older cousin play Super Mario World while I would just sit and watch him play Super Mario World, because I must have been 5 or 6 years old. Mm. And I was too dumb to play it by myself. And then as soon as I left that house, we would visit for a weekend or something, and then I would go home and I would just think about nothing but Super Mario World for weeks on end. Mm. I would just be scribbling down drawings of it, that classic thing where you're in a car and you're imagining a video game dude jumping on, I don't know, telephone wires and whatever. It was just always on my mind. Super Mario World, great game. Yeah. Classic platformer, just definitive Super Nintendo side-scroller.
So it essentially occupied a space in your mind where it was it became a mode for your creativity to express itself in other ways. It was this thing is so complex. What if this happened? And what if this happened? And what if I could make my own levels?
Yeah, that was a big part of it. I don't know, you would just look at the world map and being a kid and not having a concept of I've seen a world map before. I know what to expect from this. This is just a UI element. Mm-hmm. But when you're a kid and you're looking at that Super Mario World map, you're when you beat the level, it makes a little path and it goes over here. But you just, as an adult, you look at that and you're this is just these are the discrete levels that I can access from this UI element. But as a kid, you're thinking of it as an actual world, and you're what's actually there on that map? Mm-hmm. What does that represent? And if that path branched off somewhere else, where would it go? Mm-hmm. And you're imagining things that aren't there. And I think that's one of the cool things that video games can do to a child's brain. Mm-hmm. is make them imagine stuff that isn't even programmed into the game, but just might be there. Like, for example, in that game, like, there are secret exits in levels of Super Mario World that will branch, like, that will create different branches in the path to help you access, like, secret levels or to access the Star World or something like that. And, like, once a child realizes that, they're like, well, if there were other exits to this game, like, what else could be in there? Like, what other secrets could possibly exist? And as an adult, you lose a bit of that magic. You're kind of expecting, and you've seen it all before, right? But for a kid, that kind of stuff's like, that's my favorite stuff. That's super powerful.
I think that aspect of like discovery is like very, very much not a priority in games anymore, or it kind of happened by happenstance that you started brainstorming all the possibilities of like, well, what if you did like, this one specific move, and then there was like a secret path down here. There was a whole new branch of levels or something. And I think that definitely is that kind of idea of discovery is something that definitely drives something like the speedrun community, where they want to find every exploit of like some game.
Oh yeah, definitely. And to a degree, like I sort of like that speed running mindset of being like, I need to figure out, I need to break this game down into its code, into its components. I actually feel like that, to a degree, I feel like that kind of takes away the magic. Like you're no longer thinking of this as a living, breathing world in which anything's possible. You have you're seeing through it. You're looking at the code like Matrix style. And like you're engaging with this as a program, as like I feel like there's I respect speed running a lot, but I feel like that's kind of a different approach to gaming. And in the same sense, like when you've broken down a game so comprehensively that you know how everything works, you know how the RNG is seeded. Like I don't know, I feel like that fits in with just like you kind of got at that idea that like, oh, there's modern gaming, there's less to explore and imagine, right? I feel like a lot of that has to do with like data mining and just the nature of the internet, that like the day after the game comes out, you know all of the secrets. Like there can be no secrets in an internet age for a game.
It's very true, and it's very sad because I remember what was it? There was something, Sakurai has his little YouTube channel where he does like game development tips, and he was talking about they're developing Brawl, and when they were doing the little trailers for Sonic and Snake, that's when he realized, oh, this stuff is he's like, I didn't realize that fans of the game would share the videos around, and we didn't have to like do stuff at E3. It was kind of like, it was like that was the point in like 2007 or whatever, where he's like, oh, they want to know everything. And so then they started tailoring their custom videos for like all of the Smash reveals, because that was when we realized that the nature of the internet is that there is nothing secret and nothing sacred. That if it's there, they will find it, and they will data mine, and they will know before the developers let anyone else know.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I think like you hit the nail on the head with like 2007. I think that's like the year, or at least like the narrow band of years between, I don't know, like 2005 and 2010. That's like when that took over. Because like prior to that, like I still remember going on to like gamefAQs.com to look up cheat codes. And there's just garbage on that website. Like people would just make stuff up still and could get away with it. Like it would stay up like on the cheat code section, just like stuff that doesn't work, stuff that was just like, here's how you unlock characters that aren't in the game.
Here's
Or
how you unlock Amy Rose and Smash Brothers.
yeah, precisely, that kind of stuff. That stuff was still alive like circa 2005, and that's because I think like the internet had not matured completely yet. And like you were talking about like the Brawl trailers too. I remember, I think I was already in high school when that was happening, and I think the internet was starting to mature. And that was It's 2007, and YouTube exists, and streaming video is way more widespread now. And I think that changed the way that people like shared trailers and stuff like that, because like prior to that, like there would be an E3 conference, and you would get like the news a journalist would have had to like recount the tale to you, because it's not like E3 was broadcast on television outside of like remember like G4 or whatever those crappy like TV shows were that you had to have the right cable channel to watch. Mm-hmm. So like outside of that type of like old school like broadcast and like I don't know like games journalists recounting a conference to you in text, streaming video was the first time that really left like just the industry and became part of the home, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah,
it's a weird shift. It's funny you brought up a memory where I think it was 2004 or 2003 whenever Sonic Heroes came out. And I remember we were up at the cottage and I went to like the local library because they had computers and were like, and they had internet. And it was like, ooh. And so I went to like the Sega website or something. And I went to like the Sonic Heroes, like reveal or launch trailer. And I remember starting that, like loading that video and then using like, you know, remote, you know, dial up or whatever, having like a probably 2 minute video load over the course of like 45 minutes or over half an hour, and then finally watching it in all its glory once it finished downloading.
I love that, like,
yeah,
taking a break from your like cottage vacation in Northern Ontario or wherever.
Yeah,
being like, yeah, let's,
it was, that's, it awesome. Made it in a way because it was so onerous to get any information. You know, you go on a web page and you can see the friggin' banners or the things on the side, and the pictures load slowly in as the PNG image, you know, comes down. And because it was so hard to get any of that, like pictures or video, it felt like a sacred thing.
And yeah,
because it was so difficult to get, it was like, oh, this is like underground or cool or whatever. When it's like a multi-million dollar company that it's just trying to make it work.
And like, you have to remember that like the alternative to that at that time, I think, was like, I was talking about like online, I was thinking about like online games journalism, which which kind of became a thing in that time period. But like before that, it was print magazines.
Yeah,
Nintendo, you would have to, like, Power and outside and of Nintendo Power, but like they were also just like gamer magazines that were just kind of full of shit. Like they were full of just like, these people had no qualifications and they were just gonna like speculate about like the new game that's gonna come out, and like just make stuff up in those magazines and be like, here's what I think would be cool in the next video game. And then like they would spin theories, they were like, they would report on like rumors, just like totally rumors about secrets and stuff like that. Like, it was a wild west, man.
Like, I remember it was like John snuck into Square Enix headquarters or Square back then, and like he found the big scoop that'll shock you. That those were like the headlines.
Yeah, and like, here's the thing, like the funny joke is the uncle who works at Nintendo, right? Like that ultimate unreliable playground gossip rumor. But like that was like part of like industry journalism at that time too. Like that wasn't just kids screwing around and telling lies. Like there were like adults like buying into strange rumors and just like random journalism. I think it's great. I kind of miss it.
I miss the Wild West version of almost anything, I think. I think my favorite thing, maybe someone should do a compilation, but to look back at all the game magazines on the front covers where they were always like, you won't believe these graphics, and it's like, you know, barely 64 polygons.
Yeah. I mean, like, here's the thing, like we've come so far in terms of like graphical like fidelity, but like it's so funny to me that like I don't know, like nostalgia plays such a big role in graphics, right? That like the rise of like pixel games, and I want to say like the rise of pixel games in like 2010.
Yeah.
Like it had been long enough that like it went from being like, oh, that's just bad graphics, to like those are nostalgic graphics. And then I think we entered like low poly nostalgia, like maybe only like within the last 5 years, like widespread low poly nostalgia. I love low poly nostalgia. I think about like that those two things like make sense to me because they're so, I don't know, like they're so distinct. But like, is it possible to have nostalgia for like PS3 era graphics? Because like that's not distinct enough to be,
you know,
I don't know, maybe we just haven't come far enough to be like that's nostalgic versus like that's just not good. But like you can be N64 low poly and look like nostalgic and great, and you can be pixel graphics and look nostalgic and great. But like I heard someone refer to PS3 games as retro games for the first time. And it pained me greatly. And I think that like, I don't know, maybe it's just generational. Like we'll never be able to look at those games with a sense of like nostalgia because we weren't children when those games were coming out. But like maybe, I don't know, people who are 20 years old right now. Sorry, not to out ourselves in terms of how old we are, but I mean that's a
yeah, just secret. Keep doxing.
I don't know. Maybe they look at like, I don't know, that era of games as being very nostalgic, purely just based on experience. Like I was a kid then. Whatever was popular when I was a kid is just going to define me forever. And in the same way that Super Mario World defined my concept of what a video game is forever.
I think
do you think kids are going to be like the games that kids are exposed to are going to be the Genshins and the Fortnites, correct? Like that's what will nostalgia for those things look like? And I'm not doing a kids these days thing. It would be just far too easy to do a the kids these days are growing up on some garbage, because I mean we grew up on some garbage too. But like I'm curious about like what that nostalgia will look like in, I don't know, 10 to 20 years.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, a slice of nostalgia market or whatever is definitely going to be Minecraft nostalgia. You know, for better or for worse, or what your opinion is of Minecraft, like I enjoyed it enough, but I wasn't like a deep diver. It didn't tickle my frequency, so to speak. But I kind of like appreciated in the sense that it was like a low poly kind of game where it evoked the retro feel that we grew up with, that like, oh yeah, this thing is trying to be this thing. And again, it's the idea of looking at a game and thinking of the possibilities of it, like what's over that hill or what could I build with this thing. So in a way it's like that generation, even though they had that one game that kind of did that, I think we had a lot of games that really you know, did that. And I mean, my term for it is scalability, where like when you start a game to when you finish the game, and you like you end up with abilities that like, no, this is impossible. Like I think like I don't know, like Metroid's a good example. Like you start with your basic gun, and then you have like four different guns, and each one has like a power move, and then you have all this other like acrobatic stuff, and it's that feeling of like the possibilities of like how powered up can I get, and like what is the game gonna let me do. And I think that in Minecraft's case, it has that low poly and also that discovery and limitless kind of narrative to it that I think that, you know, that we share across a generational gap in that sense. But I've also was not exactly a doomer posting, but someone was pointing out, you do realize that eventually Skibidi Toilet will be nostalgic for someone. In fact, a lot
okay,
of people.
That drives me so like, that's so alien to me. Like these are that's a TF2 model, right?
This
that like
is
we
the
were
future
doing
you chose.
We were doing weird TF2 Gary's Mod stuff, G-mod, and like facial deformation on the TF2 heads, and then like that was gone, and like it came. How did the kids discover the TF2 cast with deformed faces? Like I don't understand how that happened. Like I'm too old to grasp.
Yeah,
how
like, what was the entry point? Around.
Like did they like stumble upon like old like 2000? I don't know, like 2010 TF2 like shit posts, and then be like, wow, that's kind of like weirdly spooky, and like the looking at like the deformed TF2 faces, they're kind of scary if you were like a child and you saw
yeah,
that
yeah.
like a fucked up face.
Mm-hmm.
And like maybe that is the basis of like, I don't know, like a fascination.
I
can only imagine that like it's not actually made by the children who are enjoying it. It's made by someone who must be like our age.
Oh yeah, no, the guy who makes the Skibidi Toilet stuff is like our age. He's been making GMOT stuff for years, you know.
Oh,
he was making normal TF2 GMOT stuff for years.
Random fame. It's truly incredible. Like no one can predict like which random shitpost will become like
king,
just a worldwide phenomenon somehow.
I think we'll eventually get to a point where we're going to have the summoning salt version for memes, where like. Like I really did not care about speedrunning until Summoning Salt, honestly, because he told a story with it. He told like a history and like the crazy things people did. And I feel like at one point someone's going to be like, okay, here's like a chart and a graph, and there's going to be like one specific user that got too obsessed with this one meme or Skibidi Toilet in this case, and he decided to just be obnoxious about it and share it with everyone until it became a thing. I wonder if they're going to be like celebrities or people who are like, this is like patient zero who spread this meme because of this thing.
I think to a degree, like that was more possible on a smaller internet.
Yeah.
Where you could be, I'm going to post this forced meme on 4chan every day until you like it.
I don't think
that's possible anymore. And I think that these things, there's like, it's a black box, and if I had to say, like, it's just some like, it's the magic of the algorithm that's just it just agglomerates. I don't know. It's just like space dust turning into a star, right? Like right. The gravity has to pull the particles together somewhere and somehow, right? Like it's going to agglomerate around something. And it could have been anything, but it happens to be Skibidi Toilet. And no one knows why. No one may be responsible. It just may be just like the collective, that was the collective center of gravity.
It might have just been happenstance.
It was just right, or maybe there was no rhyme or reason to it. It was just purely random. Who knows?
Yeah. If anything, I see it as a sign of, honestly, internet health, so to speak, in the sense that, you know, the dystopian idea is that, the algorithm at some point through YouTube or every other platform is going to be like, you will only see the content that Company X wants you to see, and that they're going to, you know, block off everything else. But the fact that a bunch of GMod singing toilet bowls fighting a bunch of security cameras is like the number one thing gives me hope that that's the human spirit is burning brightly.
Yeah, I think the kids are all right. I think there's like, it's easy to get pessimistic about the kids these days, but I think the kids are all right. They're gonna grow up with some weird fucked up stuff, but I mean, I think every generation grows up with a weird, like, fucked up thing that's unintelligible to the generation directly preceding it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we just puzzled our parents and even like the Gen Xers before us. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there was stuff that just was completely incomprehensible to them.
Yeah. And I think no matter what, there's gonna be, in every generation, there's gonna be the people who get it and the people who don't get it, and then the normies who profit from it and don't understand what they're doing and just make content about it.
Kind of like what we're doing right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Damn kids.
Yeah, we're making content.
Yeah, this is content.
I know the premise. I guess you're doing a series of these, right? Like you're trying to do a your favorite game, and I guess I just kind of just went off on a tangent almost immediately.
Yeah.
So I started with Super Mario World. Oh yeah, just to clumsily segue back to the subject of this podcast. Uh-huh. Super Mario World, but like I can't really say that that's like my favorite game. Because it's just like I didn't actually spend that much time playing it, like in terms of like a game, like I couldn't go back to play it now. Like I could mess around with it. I could play it on, I don't know, like Virtual Console. That's not what it's called anymore. Whatever the Switch.
I know what you mean.
Subscriber service is called. I don't remember what it's called. Yeah. But I might have fun with it for a little bit, but I can't call it my favorite game. There were just so many other games that like had a similar effect. In that like they just dominated the mind of like just whatever I was thinking about as a kid. Mm. I was just always thinking about a game. One of them was Super Smash Brothers Melee.
Mm-hmm.
Again, another game that I did not own that I went over to someone else's house to play. But likewise with Super Mario World, the moment that I left that house, I would count the hours and count the days until I could play it again next week when I got to go over to Filipino Bible study to play Super Smash Brothers every Tuesday. It was just like my favorite thing, and I just could not stop thinking about it. And I don't know what it is about that game. I mean, it's obviously a beloved game. Like it's many many people's favorite game. So it's popular for a reason.
Yeah, they still play it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think it was like maybe the first competitive game that I had ever played, and like the idea that you could develop mastery at something. And I was never competitive at Super Smash Brothers because I'm a scrub, but like within a circle of friends, the idea that you're honing your skills and getting better, and there's a competitive aspect. And also it's a beautiful game, just
aesthetic.
I think it was one of the first big crossover games, and that's so old hat now, and it seems like everything is a crossover game these days.
Everything is becoming a crossover game, yeah.
Yeah, but I think Super Smash Brothers as a series, and I shouldn't just say Melee, I started on 64, but like that opened a door to my child brain of like, This is kind of like the first meta thing. This is the thing about it's a game that acknowledges that games exist, right? Like it's a game that like the only reason that these characters are all here and that you know that they're all here is that you know that they're all video game characters. When you're playing the game, you're conscious of the fact that like it's a game, and it's acknowledging you as a fan of things, and it's acknowledging its history as a publishing house of Nintendo being Nintendo. I think that was really like, I can't tell you how much time, like after realizing that this was a possibility, I spent coming up with new characters in notebooks for Super Smash Brothers.
Same.
Because like once that floodgate is open, it's just like, what if video games were in other video games? You would just like every video game character, how would I make that video game character into a Smash Bros. Character? You know, it's just like constantly thinking about, I don't know, like I had terrible ideas. If I found those notebooks right now, they would just be like garbage. Like I would be like, I played I don't know, like I didn't have a lot of good games as a kid, so like I played a lot of random like Cruft that just like just ended up at my house, or that like my parents would buy, and kind of like without really thinking about it. Like I had some like crappy licensed Game Boy games. Like I had like a Bugs Bunny game, and I'm like, well, if Bugs Bunny is in this video game, that means and it's on a Nintendo console, that means Bugs Bunny should be in Smash Bros. And I was like, I was weirdly sincere about it, in a way that only a child, that really only a child can be, right? The way that only a child can't realize why something would be a bad idea. And I don't know, it occupied a lot of my thoughts constantly.
I mean, it's something that I think goes on even now, is like no one cannot admit, or like you can't deny that, what if Dante got into Smash, what would his moveset be? What would this be like? What would that be like? That's still, that magic still exists. And when Smash Ultimate was doing the DLC characters, like it was an event. Like every time a new character came out, because we bought the pass or whatever, we would, you know, get it. And so we would be like, we would all get together and then like play the game and like do the trophies and, you know, like, oh, look at his moveset and everything.
Yeah, that was so fun.
It rekindled that feeling.
Yeah. Like, to a degree, like I really enjoyed those fighters passes, and like even though I was never going to be competitive at that game, like just as an experience, that rekindled some of that childhood joy of like speculating who's next. That was really fun, but I feel like there were diminishing returns. Like when you remember like the first time you realized that Snake was in Brawl.
Yeah.
And like that blew your mind because like you were aware of the rules that this is a Nintendo thing.
Yeah.
It blew your mind. And Snake wouldn't have been my first choice. Obviously, Sonic would have been my first choice. Sonic also in that game also blew my mind. And it just kind of like, I think it was the idea that like this broke a rule, right? Yeah. That this defied your expectation of everything that you thought about Smash Bros.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made it so like vivid and appealing and special. Smash 4 did a good job of like carrying on that torch and that hype, but I feel like by the time we got to Ultimate, we were so jaded and we were so entitled that we're like, what, you guys put I don't know, like what was the first Bayonetta, crossover character? Like
Cloud?
Joker in this game, like, oh, Joker was the first.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, wait, was it, that's the first DLC third party.
Yeah. Well, that was the first DLC for Smash Ultimate was Joker.
Wrong. It was Piranha Plant.
Well, technically, yes. Yes, technically, yes.
Stupid. Everyone's plant. Favorite character, Piranha Plant. But yeah, like, I think
mad that was about that. Party. I was really mad. Like,
about Piranha Plant?
Yeah, it just felt like you wasted a spot. It felt like Sakurai, like, would like threw us like, okay, you guys keep complaining, you keep wanting more characters, here, eat dog food.
Yeah, and I do love the idea of Sakurai being like, nobody asked for this, I'm giving it to you anyways. I think that was one of the rationales behind Wii Fit Trainer, that like, we opened up this survey, no one asked for this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like, true. The North American and Japanese surveys, the number one was like, was it Sora or was it Geno? Or was it...
I feel like Sora was number one on that thing, which is why they saved it for last. Out of Kingdom Hearts. But like that brings me back to like the idea that like by the time that Sora came out, the final character, I was like burned out, right? And I'm just like, it's no longer about like the reaction video of like, it's blowing my mind, because like there are no rules being transgressed anymore, right? It's not doing anything that you thought was impossible. Everything was within your expectations, and to a degree that it was like under your expectations. We were so like entitled to be like, oh, that's not good enough, that character isn't the exact character that I wanted. We were so spoiled for choice at that point, that like remembering the magic of like, I'm Sakurai and I added one third party character and I'm a god for it.
Yeah.
And you will thank me forever, right? Versus we now have what, 85 characters in this game or however many it is. And you're going to be upset about every new one. Right?
I think my experience is that I kind of slept on Smash 4. Like, I never got a Wii U. So when I heard like Bayonetta, Cloud, and Mega Man were in Smash, I'd be like, cool, I guess. Like, I don't know. I just, that game just did not exist in my mind. I don't know what happened. I just the Wii U era was a blur to me. The only time I got, and I was super excited about Smash Ultimate and I love it, but I think the one time I did get jaded was when they added Byleth. It just like, can you please calm down with the Fire Emblem characters?
I personally don't mind that. I actually feel like Nintendo, like the idea that this is a universal crossover game now of like anything is possible. Like, I think that, like, Nintendo, like, concentrating back on its core of, like, hey, guys, remember that this is a Nintendo game? Like, this was supposed to be, like, a Nintendo thing. I feel like that's okay. Like, they do need to actually put out first-party stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if you recall, in Super Smash Bros. Melee, the idea that, like, you have Marth and Roy, as a character from the game that he's from, sucks. He's not a cool guy in Fire Emblem 6 or whatever number it is.
I've never played it. I know it was only in Japan though, right? So
yeah, that's a Japanese exclusive.
Yeah,
I played it recently and he sucks. And like the idea that you'd include this guy, but like at that point, like you're not being like, oh, they wasted a slot in Melee. You're just thinking that like, what is this cool sword guy with a sword that explodes? That's awesome, right? Mm. And like you don't even know who that is, but you're excited about it because. Potentially because you're a kid,
yeah.
and potentially because you're not jaded, because like your senses haven't been overloaded by 85 characters and decades of third party guest characters. Like I don't know, I think that like a lot of those inclusions were fine. Even the characters that I don't like, I don't know, who do I not like that they added that I'm like I could have done without.
Mm.
Yeah, like there are a lot of Fire Emblems. I know people have a problem with that. I don't like.
I mean, Cole. I will add that Byleth, yeah. they gave her / him a totally unique like moveset. It wasn't just Mirth number two. So I do at least appreciate that.
Byleth is cool.
Byleth,
I think about Corrin. I do not like Corrin.
Ugh, I don't.
Probably like just because like on the basis of the character, I think the character is stupid looking.
Yeah. And his moveset is, yeah.
It's not because it's a Fire Emblem. It's just, for me, that's just personal. I don't know why I don't like
that.
But if I think about the other third parties, the only one that really, like, surprised me and, like, made me think I didn't think that was possible was Steve.
Steve. I knew you were going to say Steve.
Yeah. Steve should not have been possible. And I didn't play Minecraft a lot, so, like, I don't have... like a huge nostalgia for it or a huge like thing for it. I think that that's such a cool thing that they did for that character to be like, hey, let's remake every single stage
and so that out of blocks,
so that the blocks work.
Yeah,
that's an insane amount of work to do.
Yeah,
and I don't like Steve. I don't like playing against Steve.
I hate Steve so much.
But I respect it for what it was able to do of bringing back the idea that like I did not think this was possible, and you did it. And that's what I appreciate about Steve Smash Bros. Ultimate.
I would have been fine with like a Minecraft world, but for me, it's like if a character gets into Smash, it's because like they have certain qualities that it's not just, oh, this guy has a good moveset or something. It's that there is something like really distinct about the character. Like they have their own lore, their own backstory. Like when you look at like a character, you'd be like, oh yeah, this would be their taunt and smash, or this would be their ultimate, or this would be their intro animation. And like you can just like, you know, you just think about it and all the possibilities. And Steve is like, in the world of Minecraft, Steve is not a character. He is just the medium by which, like, it's a first-person game, so it's just the medium by which and there's no cutscenes either, so you just explore the game through his eyes. He doesn't have any motivations or development or anything. He's just the player. And so for that reason, I just don't think he belongs. Even aesthetically, he doesn't look like he belongs. Because...
Oh, he looks like dog shit, which is hilarious to me. Like...
I put him in the class of like the Game and Watches, you know, and the Pac-Mans. I mean, they're fine, but
oh, I love Game and Watch. Like I've been playing Game and Watch since Melee. I love Game and Watches included. Such a wacky character, and I like Pac-Man too. Like I like off the wall strange inclusions, and to me, Game and Watch and Pac-Man, like they have some real history, right? Like there's obviously a deeper those games as being like progenitors. But Steve is definitely like weird, and like I'm almost certain it's just generational, the reason I don't like Steve. So I've got to like be conscious of that, and when I think about it, I'm like, you know what, if I was a kid right now, if I was 10 years old and I was playing Smash Ultimate for the first time, I would love this.
I would hate it.
What matters. They're making the game. They're making it for the kids. I'm going to let them have this one. You know, not all of these games have to be made for jaded old me. Let the kids cook, as they say.
Yeah.
I don't think I use that correctly, but I'm going to let them cook.
It's funny because now I'm thinking, well, what if they redesign Steve to make him just mesh more with the world? And then I'm immediately reminded of the horrifying, like bad 3D animated Steve poster on 4chan, who would, you know, talk about the Grinch leak, and he would make these dual threads about Steve killing Banjo or Banjo killing Steve, and that neither of them are getting in or both of them are or something.
I do not know what that is. It sounds strange. Yeah.
It was a man, like, I can't imagine in any universe that was an official marketing technique. I think it was a very, very passionately autistic man who knew how to use Blender, and he had this whole saga of like it looked like creepypasta. Steve and Banjo-Kazooie, and like they would have threads where they would fight and they would like kill each other, and then the thread would be like, you know, like 50 more days until the reveal, like who's it gonna be?
Yeah, there's something about...
It was very unhinged.
I think there's something about Smash Bros. Particular that attracts a very strange type of I'm going to call them children, but like, there's something about flavor. The obsessiveness of it it's like deeply, deeply sincere kind of fan fiction or work. I think like... one of the longest works of fiction in the English language Super Smash Brothers fan fiction, which is like a non-linear story that just like it's just an entire corpus of work that's just that's like it's impossible to parse or read.
Mm-hmm.
I like that type of like strange devotion, but like coupled with a sense of like, oh no, I'm not serious. I'm doing a parody. I'm doing satire. I'm doing weird jokes. Like I'm in on the joke. You're not. I'm in on this, right? But like, are you really like you're sincere to the degree, and you've invested so much time and effort to a degree that there's even if you claim that it's you're one of us. You're doing the funny joke. Ironically, it's just you're way too far gone. You just might not have the perspicacity to like understand what irony actually is.
Mm.
I think these children are beautiful and must be protected at all costs.
Oh yeah,
they are so sincere and so genuine and so honest. We just gotta let them, they must be protected. Cook.
Get out of the kitchen. Get off the Yelp reviews.
We have to let them like produce million word wikis of strange things that only make sense to them.
Mm-hmm. Like a codex, and like I think that branches almost into a larger conversation about genuineness versus cringe. You know, I remember when the internet basically started, like everyone was genuine, everyone was super passionate about everything. And then there was a point where everything was cringe and everyone tried to find all the cringe possible. And then people stopped being genuine because of that. And I feel like that was, in a way, the death of the internet as the early internet as we knew it.
I definitely agree with that. Like a big thing for me is just like the idea that people are going to find me on this web, and they're going to make fun of me for not knowing the right rule. It was for me. It was like my first time on 4chan. It's just like you don't know all of the funny in jokes. It felt like being in a virtual locker room, and it was just like ostensibly these are all the nerds, right? That like our founding myth is that like we're all nerds, right? Like, and you think of like 1980s movies of like nerds and lockers and jocks and bullies, right? Mm-hmm. Which was obviously like never actually true and is mostly just like a product of media stereotypes. But like the idea that like, hey, when you gave the nerds their own space and they were in control, guess what the first thing that they did was? Is like turning nerd things into hierarchical, like jock style, like bullying, right? The stereotypical, like, everything's a dick measuring contest. Everything on this hellhole website is about like, I'm gonna one up you. Your opinion is wrong, and your opinion's wrong because my opinion's right. Everything here is like you transgressed some unwritten rule. And I'm gonna humiliate you for it publicly. The entire idea of the lolcow culture of like, hey, we found a weirdo. Let's ruin them. Look at how bad this person that you would otherwise would never have thought about or never would have known about. And let's punish them because they're so or whatever, right? People looking for drama, looking to pick fights. Yeah. I think the internet, I think it pretty quickly turned into that, or at least as we were coming of age. I feel like we witnessed that
happen quite quickly. And it's interesting too, because I've reflected about this a lot because it happened recently where I was watching, well, not recently, a couple of years ago, someone was doing like a review of like, not a review, but they were ranting about like Doom Eternal or something. And for some reason, some for godforsaken reason, there's like a schism between people who like Doom 2016 and Doom Eternal, which came out in 2018, that if you like one of these games, you hate the other one and you have to take a side. And anyway, I was just watching this thing and this guy was making a bunch of really good points, but then he like, I don't want to get like too much into it, but he was basically saying, oh, those people who don't like Doom Eternal, they're playing the game wrong. They're doing it wrong. And I realized at that moment that all those conversations or arguments about like games back in the day, that what make games unique as a medium is that it's not passive, and it's not a unidirectional form of media, that it is dependent on the person experiencing it. You know, you can turn on a movie and you can watch it, or you can have it on the background or not even not pay attention, but more or less you're getting the same experience as pretty much everyone else. But with a game, like the way you have a piece of music, depending on what you do and how you play it and doing your own thing and your own expectations, your experience is actually going to be different from someone else's. And that's why when people say, this is my favorite game, someone says, no, your game is a piece of shit. I played it and I hate it. And because my big brother jumped in on me and like, you know, took the control and said I was doing it wrong. Like, I don't know. There's something so extremely personal about playing a video game that other people don't want to be invalidated and have their opinions and experiences invalidated because of it, whether it's positive or negative.
Yeah. And like, I think, like a big part of early video games journalism, and especially like, I don't know, I want to say 2010 era, like Destructoid and every other game website out there, is that like, we have to rate the games. Every game needs to have a numerical score.
Yeah.
And like that's just such a stupid way to think about any type of media, make any sense. But it was such a fundamental, like you couldn't think about games without attaching a number to it.
It was definitely a way to be like, oh, we're official. We put a number on this. We're so official that we put numbers on things.
Yeah, and like the idea that like, do you remember when every video game like rating had to be broken down on like graphics, story, gameplay, as if those things are like discrete elements that you could just like strip away from each other.
Yeah.
It was such a bad way. A bad, bad, bad way. We were tied to it for so long. That's how we. I don't know why we. Who invented that? Like that must have gone back to like the era of print, like magazine journalism or something like that. I don't know. Like, you would never rate a movie like that, right? But like, here's how I rated the movie. The music. Cinematography. This movie. Here's how I rated the. Well, I guess that's how they do Oscars, right? They award Oscars on basis of the music was good, the editing was good. I don't know. I think it's quite laughable. Oh man. And like the idea that like people would get mad that like you gave this game the wrong number.
If it was one digit off, it was a 6 instead of a 7, that would mean death.
And also the idea that like no game got less than out of 10, like no game would get less than a 5. So like what was the point of numbers 1 through 4 if nothing was ever, it was like, it's like getting a failing grade in school, right? That like, yeah, if it's below 50%, well, percents 1 through 49 were useless. We never used those percents. It was just like 50 was the bottom, which is stupid rating system. Not that rating systems at all are useful, but it's just a weird strange times. And be like, this person was biased, gave them the wrong number, and this was the genesis of this was, yeah, I'm gonna wade into some sketchy territory here, but this was the genesis of Gamergate, that like someone is rating a game too high. The number is wrong, and the basis of the number is wrong led to this movement, which people have done some anthropology and some sociology and history on this stuff, is the basis for the political awakening of a lot of people. Like for a lot of young men, this was their first mass movement that they attached their identity to. These are people who prior to this were not political and maybe did not have strong opinions on anything ideological issue. But this, the number was wrong, is going to be the thing that radicalizes them.
It really makes me reflect, actually, like the kind of not insanity, but like the like we're assigning a number to like a very pretty emotional and subjective experience. Like, who goes to a symphony and be like, oh, that was a 5. That was a solid 5. Could have been a 7. I feel like that's just like it's derived from how games were made, how at the end of like a level you would get like an A rank or something, that okay, the game experience also has to have this kind of very distinct outcome, this distinct number that summarizes the whole experience.
Well, to be honest, I think it comes from movies, right? The Roger Ebert, right? 5 stars, thumbs up, thumbs down. And like that's,
but he would just say thumbs up, thumbs down, and we should have left it at that. But people, I guess, because games do have so many like things, like there are games I've played where like the gameplay wasn't very good, but the music was like really, really good, and it's like, well, I really like the music, and so I want to rate it something else. And I think this branches off to like a slightly another thing. There was some study done at the Yale or something where they tried to distinguish the reward centers for different people in games, and they said there were basically 3 types of gamers. There were gamers who enjoyed narrative, strategy, or competition. So competitive would be like fighting games, strategy would be like RTSs and like Factorio, Minecraft and stuff, and then narrative are things like Zelda and Nier, I guess.
Like genre is such a big thing. Like for so long, like, our concept of genre was like based on a very, just, do you remember when action was a genre of game?
I remember that. Like, was it 2011?
Like, that's like every game, right?
Yeah.
Like,
but you perform actions. Shocking.
Yeah, like we should have better categories these days. And like you said, like games that are explorative, games that are about about building, that are creative or constructive, games that are competitive, games that are etc.
Because I think like the thing is, if you take a strategy type person and you give them a competitive or a narrative game, they're going to hate it, and they're going to give it a low score if they are a game journalist or reviewer or whatever, because that game is not meant for them. And it's a weird thing. Like, it's a weird thing to say. It's like, oh, this piece of media wasn't made for you. Like, it doesn't cater to your interests. And then that like opens up a can of worms where it's like, you know, is there a game that is universally loved? Like, I can think of a couple, and then there are games that are universally hated. But then there are games that some people really, really love. And then there are, and then that same game is hated by a certain type of person. And it's the, it's that aspect of subjectivity that just muddies the water, where someone wants to say something is, you know, it's the difference between saying this game is really, really good, or this game, in my opinion, is really, really good, or it's really, really good for me.
Yeah. I mean, like, to draw a parallel to movies again, which I keep coming back to, is that, like, what's the difference between a horror movie and, a, like, a comedy and something else, right? Like, these are all movies that serve extremely different functions, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't know, like, you have to judge games on the basis of what they were trying to accomplish in the same way that you judge movies on what they were trying to accomplish. And I think, like, people who review movies, they review all types of movies. Like, they'll review a horror a movie, and they'll review a, I don't know, like a romance or something like that. And I think that, like, people are generally intelligent enough to be like, well, this romance movie wasn't very scary. and you know, that's a pretty stupid way to review a movie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you're onto something about, like, games that, like, some people do not grasp.
Sorry, my internet cut out. I think someone reset the modem or something. But if you want to go back and just touch on your favorite thing or your favorite game, and yeah.
Sure, yeah. So, favorite game, whatever games that you play as a kid, it's like your first love. It's going to be your favorite game. I got a lot of those. There are games that I encountered as a teenager or as an adult, which I love a lot too, but ultimately I don't think you can beat your first love. Just like, I guess honorable mention, I love Earthbound. I love Undertale. I love those, like, RPGs that manage to surprise you a lot. I'd put Earthbound and Undertale, like, in that class of RPG, but, like, the third one that I'd put there, Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden, episode one of the Hoops Barkley saga. It seems like a weird fit, but it's also a indie RPG that makes me laugh like nothing else. It just, like, surprises you constantly and uses your knowledge of RPGs to, like, subvert your expectations of RPGs. Specifically, Undertale and that game, I think, have a lot in common, and I love both of those. My favorite game that I regard as, like, an artistic game, Kentucky Route Zero.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. I don't really think I can say a lot about it. I don't know if I have the right, like, words to talk about how much I like that game, but I like that game a lot. I don't even necessarily know if it's a game. It's just something that I like a lot because it's beautiful, I guess, just aesthetically, but it's not a very fun game if I had to rate it on the basis of fun. Again, talking about ratings. A lot of other weird games formative to me were, like, just the random garbage that I had access to as a child because my parents wouldn't buy me real video games. Flash games, like, shitty Flash games.
Oh, yeah.
Love Game, a dating sim Flash game, had an outsized influence on my child brain.
Yeah.
Lego Island is a game that my parents bought me, which is garbage, but I love. Like, I think there's so much, like, about that game which is so badly designed. And it was in an era where, like, 3D games were, like, not common. Like, this came out, like, maybe, like, the year, I don't know, it might have come out in the year, like, 1998 or something like that. And 3D is not good. The 3 is so terrible, and we don't know what we're doing. Yeah, like, it's N64 era.
Right.
Yeah, it's really bad. But, like, I spent so long in it. That's the game that made me discover that I get motion sickness. So that's important. Paper Mario is another one. That's one of the, like, the proper first-party games that I actually owned. That was just, like, a solid game. It introduced me to the concept of RPGs. Prior to that, like, I didn't have a concept of what that type of game was. To me, like, RPGs that I played after that, because I didn't have an awareness of genre, was like games that are like Paper Mario. And like, I'm like, why doesn't this RPG have like action commands, and where are my partners, and like that's not how normal RPGs work. That's just how Paper Mario works. So that was really formative for me. A lot of other RPGs, things that I could emulate, because I wasn't able to buy games for myself, I would just get SNES games, because that was really accessible at the time that I was a teenager. So I just played a lot of SNES RPGs, Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI. Before that, I was using NES emulators, and part of that was because like I wasn't allowed to download anything onto my computer, and there was a browser-based NES emulator. And so like that was one of the few things that was accessible to me, and so I played a lot of NES RPGs that you had to save to your cookies in a browser, and if those cookies got refreshed, it would erase your save. So like I would just like try to play through as much of Final Fantasy I or Final Fantasy III as I could, and beat them within like a matter of days, because I'm like, well, I this save is on shaky ground. A lot of these games are super important to me. I can't really say that any one of them is my favorite. But yeah, like the history of playing games is the history of like your childhood and your adolescence and your adulthood. These are all important to me at different times of my life. These are a list of favorite games.
I mean, it's interesting that there's multiple. Do you think it's possible that in the future you could actually play a game and be like, wow, this makes me feel like how I felt back then. This is like my new favorite game.
To be honest, no.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's about the state of games. I think that's just like becoming a adult. Your expectations are ruined forever. I think the one way that some people encounter that is like people who have children get to experience that vicariously through like showing that child a game for the first time and seeing the wonder in their eyes. I played on Kirby Star Allies with my niece, who was I must have been 4 or 5 at the time, and this is I think the first video game she's ever played. So she was I noticed that like when she plays the game, she doesn't look at the screen, she's looking at the controller, because it feels foreign in her hands, right? And it's probably just like it's also really big in her hands, and like she doesn't know how to move, right? And like I remember being like that as a kid, and like just my first exposure to video games and being like scared to lose or scared to do something wrong, but like also be like just totally entranced by the colors and the sounds. And so getting it, being able to witness that again is pretty special.
Yeah. So if you can't experience it directly, you can like almost have it vicariously through other people, other kids who are discovering it. I think that's solid. I personally actually disagree. I think it is possible, I think, for some game to come out and just blow out expectations like Elden Ring or something. I actually haven't played it yet, but I think I have hope that there's a game out there that that childlike wonder may actually be possible, as foolish as that faith may be, but a time will tell.
Oh yeah, you got to just keep looking for it then, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I do. It's what I do on my channel, which you should all come check out. you're probably on it since you're watching this video. But anyway, I think that's kind of a good end point. Did you want to end off with anything else?
No, I think this has gone on for long enough.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, it was really nice having you on, and thanks for coming on and just being passionate about your old games.
Hell yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem.